Get in the game at Albertsons. We're kicking off the football season with big prizes. Look for Game On participating player tags, buy any three, and enter your code for a chance to win. Get Tide laundry detergent 42 to 50 ounces or Pods 12 to 16 count, $4.99 each. And Bounty paper towels, 12 big rolls or 6 huge rolls, $11.99 each when you buy two. No purchase necessary. Open to residents of Southern California counties listed in rules 18 years and older. Ends January 9th, 2018. Enter code by January 12th, 2018. Rules at GameOnSoCal.com.
Once upon a time, there was a new crossover that refused to play by the rules. It flipped the script and made all the others look like fools. Featuring styling that's sexier by far and handled like a rock star. Introducing the first ever Toyota CHR.
Enjoy agile handling in the body of a seductive crossover that comes with standard 18-inch alloy wheels. The first ever Toyota CHR. The perfect ride to spin your own tail. Toyota. Let's go places.
If you want a sandwich with savory meat and tangy marinara sauce, you'll love today's Sub of the Day at Subway Restaurants. Because today and every Sunday, you can get a 6-inch meatball marinara sub with any veggies you want on your choice of freshly baked bread for just $3.50. It's a different sub every day. So tomorrow it's sweet onion chicken teriyaki, and Tuesday it's oven roasted chicken. It's the $3.50 sub of the day, only at Subway Restaurants. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Additional charge for extras and deluxe. Plus tax where applicable.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn. You tell me. You call from. You call from.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. There was a time in my life when life came down on me like a giant anvil and just wouldn't stop squashing me into the ground. Now, I come from one of those Midwestern pull-yourself-up-by-your-bootstrap families, but no matter how I tried or what I tried, for quite some time, I could not yank myself out of it. Now, on my write-up on my site for the show, one of my longtime blog commenters wrote, "Maybe I am a natural rebounder, but I find it difficult to commiserate with people who live in the most prosperous nation on earth and yet cannot realize their advantage." Now, it is understandable that someone who has only seen depression from the outside would say that, but as someone who's been there on the inside, I can assure you this is not the case. There are so many misconceptions about depression and how to treat it, and I'm especially excited to bring you tonight's show with Dr. Jonathan Rottenberg, psychologist and director of the Mood and Emotion Laboratory at the University of South Florida. He has written an inspiring, eye-opening, and scientifically rigorous book, The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. And he offers a new model for seeing and treating depression that I think makes a lot of sense. So stick with us and hear why we get depressed and how a depressed person might come back from the depths. Hello, John.
Hello, Amy. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm so excited about this because you really do some breakthrough stuff in your book. And you talk about how deep depression destroys the ability to do. And you quote this one woman, Sylvie. She described the worst point of her depression as walking around in a concrete dress.
Yes. One of the amazing puzzling things about depression is how an able-bodied person who's a smart person, who's a good person, finds that one day they can't get out of bed. They try, they want to, but they really can't. Depression is just that imprisoning.
And now you yourself suffered a major depression. And I wonder if researchers who study depression tend to be people who've experienced it themselves.
I think that's probably true. In my case, I suffered from a punishing depression. It lasted over 4 years. It nearly destroyed my life, and the experience was so profound that I felt absolutely compelled to try and understand what had happened to me. So I changed fields. I was studying to be a historian, and suddenly that didn't seem so relevant anymore, and I went into the field of psychology.
And now, there's this widespread belief that you write about that depression stems from defects. So tell us about that and why you feel this is leading to us losing the fight against depression.
Sure. I mean, it is the number one idea that the reason that we have depression is that the person who's suffering from depression has something profoundly the matter with them. There's a defect. It might be in their brain. It might be in their genes. It might be in their mind, a cognitive defect, bad thoughts, and that we can simply understand that, treat that, and depression will go away. And we've made major investments in depression treatment and depression research using this defect model. As you know, antidepressants, for example, are a very common treatment for depression. And yet this work hasn't slowed the depression epidemic. In fact, it's only grown. And I think it actually doesn't help us understand why we have a depression epidemic in the first place.
Well, you say that all these deficiency approaches start from the same place, that depression and its symptoms are proof that something fundamental is wrong. And I know, and you say, it sounds a little odd to say this because depression is unpleasant and impairing, but you think that actually, you talk about how there are actually things that make sense about depression in an evolutionary sense, how depression would have been a helpful thing in certain environments.
Absolutely. So the only way that we can understand why we have depression is to first understand why it is that we have mood in the first place. So depression, serious depression, is in a sense mood gone wrong. And so the perspective in the book is to understand all the forces that are pushing on mood. And mood I see as an adaptation. Mood is ordinarily something that's very useful, something that we have and that other animals have, that provides us with a lot of guidance. The guidance about what to do in different environments. And kind of the guidance that mood provides for behavior actually helped our ancestors survive. So it's easy to imagine high moods are useful. We can think, you know, of the bear fishing for salmon. It's a beautiful day, and looking in the water and seeing all these fish jumping, and all it has to do is reach its paw into the water. That's a high mood. It's saying, keep going. There are rewards present. But we don't often think that low moods, too, are useful. But if we think of the same example, the same bear, imagine a bear that's sitting by the bend of the river and there are no salmon whatsoever, and it just keeps reaching into the water, and days go by. There has to be some mechanism to get us to stop, to recognize when our efforts aren't paying off, when we need to do something different, or when the environment is so adverse that there's actually nothing that we can do, so we don't waste our efforts, so we don't starve, so we don't, you know, harm ourselves or do things that are very risky. So both high and low mood types have utility.
I just wanted to backtrack a little because mood is one of those things where we think we know what it means, but I think people don't have the understanding. The way you describe it, I love. You say moods are internal signals that motivate behavior and move us in the right direction. So that was sort of what you were describing with the bear, no salmon. It moves us away from the river that's not a fruitful place to be.
Right, or, you know, there's a time and a place for everything. So when predators are lurking, it's not a good time to do a mating dance. So if you're in the middle of a blizzard, it's not a good time to try out your new hiking skills, try out your new compass, right? So these are all cues that it's time to pull back, that, you know, we recognize, that other animals recognize. And without this, we would be in big, big trouble. And it's easier to see, you know, related adaptations like anxiety, which protects us from threats, that you can all see that a little bit of anxiety might be useful, but so moods are ordinarily a good adaptation, but like anxiety, they're not perfect. And we can have debilitating low mood just as we can have debilitating anxiety.
And now you talk about the processes of the mood system, and you say that the first step for our mood system is figuring out what kind of situation it's in, the internal situation, like do we have anxiety, and the external situation, and then it integrates what's favorable for us to do in terms of our goals related to our survival and our reproduction.
That's absolutely right. I mean, moods are kind of all-knowing. We are always one step behind. So, for example, your mood system is aware of what's going on in your body, and you've probably woken up with a cold, and you've not wanted to do things, and you felt sluggish, and you felt tired, and you're actually not in a good mood at all. And your brain can literally read out what's going on in your immune system, and take from that this signal. But it's in addition to things inside the body, it's also cues outside of the body, events in our world, the amount of light that we get, a whole manner of things. And we're not always aware what the sources of our mood are, in part because so many things are working on our mood at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's really important to recognize. And you write in your book, The Depth, that mood computations are automatic. I love this thing you said. You said the goat is unaware and is doing evolution's bidding when it eats a carrot. But I think that that's something that if we recognize, if we understand mood the way you're talking about and understand how it affects us, it can maybe help us direct our moods in more productive ways in terms of the times we live in. Since we evolved, you know, we're not dealing with hungry tigers so often in our environment.
That's right. And, I mean, I would also say that part of the problem with the defect model of depression is that we've kind of been taught not to listen to what our moods might have to say. Moods are, in depression, if you have this defect model, you know, you just have faulty neurotransmitters. You don't need to look for, you know, the internal and the external sources of the moods. You just need to take a pill, and there really isn't all that much to talk about. And so in many ways, the book is a plea for mood literacy in addition to presenting the science of what we know about moods and the things that affect mood and might be important in propelling someone into a serious depression.
And I just wanted to just talk again about that defect model. That this is this idea that therapists and doctors have, that the symptoms of depression, they reside in deficiency in your brain, in your soul, in your childhood, in your relationship with your significant other, you know, and your approach, this mood approach, is really pretty revolutionary.
Well, thank you. You know, in many ways, the defect model is very well intentioned, and it has led to a number of things that are positive. However, one of the things that didn't come out of the defect model, which was intended to kind of relieve people of the burden of thinking that it was something wrong with their character. So if you have low neurotransmitters, it's not that you're, you know, a weak person. But the problem is that, as it turns out, the belief that you have a bad brain, it makes people not know what to do or not know what to say about their depression. And it's also not true in the sense that we haven't located the single defect in neuroscience, for example, is still very much in the realm of hypotheses, none of which have really panned out in terms of a serious biological correlate that's necessary or sufficient for depression. I'm glad that you think that it is appropriate to think about alternatives.
Oh, yeah. And, well, you support this very well in your book, The Depth. And I'm talking with Dr. Jonathan Rottenberg. His book is The Depth, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. And one thing you say is so sad, and I see this from my own family's perception of any kind of psychological disorder. You know, if you broke your leg, they'd take you to the hospital. But there's still so many people who think going to a psychiatrist to get help for a problem with your brain is a sign that you are defective. And this stops sufferers from getting help. And also, people, there seem to have cooties. You gave this heartbreaking quote in your book. You included a psychiatrist at an inpatient facility said, "I work in a hospital with 600 beds. It has no gift shop, and it has no gift shop because there isn't the human traffic of people coming to visit people when they're feeling at their worst." And I think if you're with your mood, with your notion, which really seems well supported about mood being at the root of this, that maybe that it wouldn't have that stigma.
Yeah, I agree, and it really is a very tragic. So if you're in bed because of you have a back injury, people will come and bring you a casserole, and they really do feel like they know what to say. They know how to help, and you have also an explanation. I hurt my back. I was lifting too much, and that's very comforting. But if you're in bed because you have a depression, other people, they might want to help, but they really don't know what to say. And often the sufferer doesn't know what to say or know what to think about their problem. And so everyone is kind of trapped, often with good intentions, in the stigma is both other people thinking, well, this person, as you say, has cooties, but often the depressed person thinking, maybe I have cooties. I know I was that way. When I was depressed, I didn't understand what was the matter with me or how to talk about it. It was very threatening and it was very upsetting. And I was kind of imprisoned by this self-stigma and the stigma of depression. And I felt that it really is high time to see if we can find a way to have a broader national conversation about depression, mood disorders, and how to help people who are suffering.
And now let's talk about this sort of puzzling reality that my commenter brought up. You write about this in your book. You say that human depression is increasing in an era when environmental conditions are relatively benign. And but you say that the environment depression disconnect seems less strange when we appreciate the roots of depression.
Right. Well, depression has many roots. So we've talked so far about the kind of primitive machinery of mood, the building blocks of mood, and the kind of the environmental analysis that the mood system does, and that's great. But with humans, we're a very special kind of mammal. And our species has created a unique environment, a cultural environment, a physical environment that unfortunately, especially in the last 10,000 years, has become very hospitable for low mood. And a lot of these factors have only increased in the last century or even the last 30 or 40 years. So I would point out things like the amount of sleep that people get. So in 1900, surveys, our best data indicate that people sleep on average about an hour and a half more than they do now. And we know that sleep is very restorative for the mood system. We know that we evolved in lighting conditions where reliably people were out in the sunshine during the day, and at night they were in darkness and asleep. But now people are getting light at the wrong times. People are inside during the day. Not everyone, obviously, but a lot of people are inside during the day. And they might be getting artificial light, which is really not any different than dwelling in a cave. And then at night, we have, you know, artificial illumination. Light is coming off of TV screens, iPads, iPhones. And this is really wreaking havoc with our natural body clock and our 24-hour mood rhythms. So there's a number of things that are going on in our contemporary environment that are pretty bad for mood. They're kind of setting the stage for people to have low mood pretty routinely.
And now I suspect that my own depression, beyond psychological causes and stresses and problems in my life back then, has something to do with dieting and not getting enough fat and possibly getting a lot of carbs. I mean, it's very low-fat, low-calorie diet, you know, to be thin, and I ate sugar and flour. And you write about the Minnesota starvation experiment that simulated famine.
Right. That's a really great example to bring up. So it would make sense, right, one of these adverse environments where we've been designed to pull back our behavior repeatedly over the course of animal evolution and human evolution have been famines. And this is a very strong cue to reduce your level of activity. And what happened in the Minnesota starvation experiment, really interesting. These were conscientious objectors, World War II. They agreed to be part of the study to understand the effects of starvation and how to refeed people, which they expected after the war ended, that they would be going to the U.S. would be going to Europe and helping people who were in starvation. Well, in the midway through this experiment, unintentionally, they were surprised to learn a very high percentage of the subjects in the experiment became depressed. That they had all the symptoms of low mood and all the many of the symptoms of depression. And this is because starvation, and it can be, you can bring this on by not getting enough nutrition for a long period of time. And people with, for example, anorexia nervosa have a lot of depression as well. And it really isn't a surprise when you think, how was the mood system designed? What situations was it looking to? Starvation is one where it's very important. You're more likely to survive if you're not doing jumping jacks and, you know, running 5 miles when you have insufficient calories.
And you're talking about an adaptation, which is the way an organism changes to become better suited to deal with the challenges of its environment. So with a famine, our body shuts down, like you're saying, to deal with a lessened food. You know, and this is an example that fits with what you're saying about low mood from the research of Randy Nessie and other people, that it's a protective thing for us. It helps us deal better with these environmental problems, but there can be some real cost to it. And you say that doing nothing can be risky, and a window of opportunity might close, and it's hard for our system in modern times to balance these complexities of our society.
Absolutely. So Nessie would say, and I would agree with him, that moods are a good adaptation, but like all adaptations, they're not perfect. And it depends what kind of environment the adaptation is. So deer evolve to freeze at the sign of danger. But if that danger is a car, approaching car and the headlights of the car, that's not a very useful adaptation. And deer that freeze in that situation get run over. So too, you know, humans have this propensity to become depressed in certain kinds of environments, but the very recent environment has a lot of problematic elements. It most certainly is making depression worse than it otherwise would be, because it's not a perfect adaptation by any means.
Well, can understanding how low mood shuts us down help us? You know, can we not be that meta? You know, that sort of able to think about our own thinking.
Oh,
in the moment.
We can absolutely think about our own thinking. So let me just give you an example. So one thing that is great about humans, and this is also sort of flipping the defect model. Defect model would say, oh, humans are like uniquely defective. Well, you know, that's why they have so much depression. Well, actually, we have depression so much in humans in part because some of the things that we do best. So humans are great at using language and telling stories about ourselves. So, you know, chimpanzee can feel bad, but only human being can feel bad about feeling bad. And that's a really cool thing. It's often very useful. However, feeling bad about feeling bad can set in motion this spiral, right? We think the thought. The chimpanzee, I don't think, can have the thought, I'm a terrible mother, but a human being can have that thought and turn it over and over and over in their head, in her head, for days and hours. And the good news is that becoming aware that some of these things which we might think of as strengths and can become liabilities are ways to try to break the cycle of depression. And we become aware of the different sources of our mood. And so part of the sources, one of the sources, is what you're saying about the meta. So the approach that we take to our mood can make a big difference.
Yeah, that is really good news. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about our pursuit of happiness, which you say can get us into trouble. But first, a word about my show's new sponsor, Audible.com. They are the leading provider of audiobooks, which I love to listen to in the car. They make me less likely to want to kill somebody with a golf club who's driving in front of me. You can get a free audiobook download and support this show financially at no cost to you by signing up for a free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/AmyA. It's $14.95 a month after 30 days, but you can cancel before then and have it cost you nothing and still give me a kickback. So to get that, it's audibletrial.com/AmyA. And if you forget that, the link is in the online blurb for this show. And tonight, my guest is Dr. Jonathan Rottenberg, psychologist and director of the Mood and Emotion Laboratory at the University of South Florida. And his very insightful book is The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. So back to happiness. You say our pursuit of happiness can get us into trouble. So tell us about that.
Sure. There's nothing more American than the pursuit of happiness, and the last thing I would want my book to do to anyone is to make someone think I shouldn't bother to try to be happy. One of the meta things that we can do as humans is to set goals for our mood. And in the U.S., and in many other Western countries, we set extremely high standards for our happiness. In our culture, you know, people look on Facebook and they see smiling families and people on vacation. They take from that, I should feel happy. I should feel really happy. I should feel elated. I should feel really good about my life. like most of the time. And unfortunately, that really is asking the impossible. I think very few people actually feel that way, actuarially, if you were to do an inventory. Plus, having those sorts of extremely high standards for happiness is one of the things that gets people set up in one of these loops. And so someone feels just okay, or someone feels a bit down, or someone feels pretty down, and they notice that, and they say, what's wrong with me? Why am I not happy? Why am I'm not feeling as happy as these other people over here? And that actually makes it worse. Other countries, for example, in East Asia, people don't have this idea that you should necessarily, the most important thing to feel all the time is excited or feeling high or hyper or feeling euphoric. To be calm or to feel contentment or to feel satisfied, is that's more of the goal. But in the West, we have this idea that you can feel like on top of the world, like pretty regularly. And the mood system really isn't designed for that state. It's actually not really designed for happiness at all. It's really designed for survival and to allow us to reproduce. So we're kind of working against how we were put together in the first place, and that's a hard thing.
Yeah, I was very struck by that section in your book, The Depths, about how Americans, you know, the media environment tells us to, you know, we need to have peppy happiness, and it seems much more reasonable to take this sort of Asian approach of calm and serenity and contentment, and to recognize, you know, this guy said, yes, we have, you know, our country, we have all these, it's very easy here, all these quote-unquote blessings, but you can be grateful for them and not feel bad that you are, you know, at the same time having other problems.
Right.
You know, that whole model, I think, is so damaging, that notion that, you know, oh, well, how awful of you, you entitled person, that you don't, you know, immediately wash away your depression with the thought about, oh, well, we all have refrigerators.
Right, that's exactly right. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of your listeners look at themselves and they say, why am I not more happy? And that can be a very threatening thought because why am I not happy? You try to analyze, why am I not more happy? I should be happier. That actually doesn't make people happier to have that thought. It kind of deepens their despair very often and gets people in these loops where they are having these thoughts all the time. And it's very difficult to exit this loop. And if you step back and say, actually, my goal is to tolerate. I'm going to try to tolerate some degree of unhappiness, realize that's a part of the experience that most everyone has, then it actually will diminish the extent to which you're fixating on how happy you are. And you actually may be happier because you'll be thinking about other things. You'll set other goals for yourself. Your goal won't be to be happy. Your goal will be to be a good husband or a productive worker or something like that, that actually if you achieve it, you'll feel happier as a byproduct.
Yeah, and that was an important point you made, that happiness comes as a byproduct while you're doing other things, that this sort of incessant chasing of it and feeling bad if you're not gleeful at every moment, that really is not the way to get it.
Right. I mean, I think I paraphrased John Lennon. It's something like happiness is something that happens when you're busy making other plans. That, you know, it actually is not like other goals. It's not like learning to play the piano, you know, where you get the book and you practice hard. You're going to get better at the piano. But if you try to practice hard at becoming happy, it's sort of like running on a treadmill that keeps going faster the harder you work. And I think a lot of people have experienced a terrible frustration with that. I think that the book is relatively new in asking people to step back and examine this, as you say, this meta level on which moods work.
Yeah, and you just mentioned the treadmill, and that's one way they call it, either hedonic treadmill or hedonic adaptation. I've had Sonia Lubomirsky on my show who researches that, and she's talked about how we so quickly get used to both positive and negative changes in our lives, and people expect those new boobs to make them happy and to be as exciting they were at day two, you know, at month three, and they're just not, and they feel like failures because of that. And you also write about how valuing happiness is a real problem, you know, that can really cause a problem for us.
Yeah, this is another place where I think the evolutionary perspective really buys us something that the other perspectives don't have. So if we think about a bunny, and a bunny likes carrots. So bunny gets a carrot, it feels happy, briefly. But that happiness is very fleeting, and that is to motivate the bunny to get another carrot. Imagine the bunny stayed happy forever. Doesn't motivate it to do what it needs to do in order to survive. So humans too, you know, it could be any goal, something really abstract or something really concrete. So, you know, when Bill Gates makes the $1 billion, he feels good. But then he immediately after that phase, he says, so when am I going to make the next billion? So it really doesn't matter what level of success or how important the goal is. There is this, as you say, adaptation, which is essentially that we're always, by design, seeking. We have a seeking system, and it doesn't reach satiation upon reaching a goal, because we've never finished. We're always like the bunny, motivated to find the next carrot. And just realizing that, realizing that is part of our equipment, that is part of our makeup, is kind of liberating in the sense that you don't have to get down on yourself if after you get the goal and it fades, that there's something wrong with you. That happens to virtually everyone.
Yeah, and persistence is such a big goal in our culture. And you say that, you know, we need to realize when, you know, we're engaged in a failing enterprise, because otherwise that is when we get into this low mood.
Yeah. And again, this is going to sound maybe a little bit contrarian, but I think it's really true, and I could use my own case as an example. So many of us grew up with parents that love us, and that's wonderful. And it's not only parents. We hear this in the classroom, that if you really want something, that no matter what it is, that it's a matter of effort. And it's a very American view. And I think there's clearly some good that comes of this view. However, it tends to blind us to situations in which we're pursuing a goal that is vanishingly unlikely to be achieved in its ambition. And we keep pursuing it even when there's obvious signs that it's failing. And this is really a recipe for depression. And I say, you know, my own example, because I think that is part of what happened to me when, as a young man, I was pursuing a PhD in history, and I was a darn good historian, but it was and is a very hard row to hoe, and there were signs all around that I was working on a topic that was unlikely to pay off, and I got in this deepening low mood, in part because I was not getting the kind of success that I thought I would have originally. And rather than saying, hey, maybe I should step back and rethink what I'm doing, I just kept redoubling my effort, and my mood just got worse and worse. And at some point, I couldn't even read a book. I was so incapacitated. And so sometimes your mood system kind of makes a decision for you about a goal that you just is saying you're not going to pursue this. But people can go years dug in to unbelievably ambitious goals and getting this is another spiral that people can get into. So it's very hard, but part of this recognition about the mood system being very sensitive to goals is that we should be very careful about what goals we think are the most important, the only thing, the must-have, because I think there's many factors in our culture that say you should not even be satisfied unless you're the best. You don't mean that the best of the best. And that could be very punishing to people when it's not going to happen.
So it sounds in a sense like depression is trying to inject realism into our lives in a certain way, and it can be maladaptive, but you draw the line between these more shallow depressions and severe depressions in terms of, it seems that there are more advantages from a sort of shallow depression, but you can let it sink into a major one by not maybe taking the cues.
Right. I mean, so I think that one reason we have more severe depression, probably the main reason, is that we have more people who are in chronically low mood. and in low mood for a whole host of reasons, including how people are caring for their bodies in the environments that people are in. And often what will happen is that you're walking around with low mood and then something else will happen. Often depressions happen when a person takes a big hit. Serious happens in their life. For example, a person gets divorced. But if you're already compromised, if you're already in a low mood, the odds that this is going to deepen and be something that overwhelms you increases. And so the book considers all the different things that happen to people, and that many people are in already a pretty compromised state because they're chronically unhappy with the goals that they're setting. They're in an environment that's very punishing to their moods, and then they have something very serious that happens to them, like they lose their job or their marriage dissolves or they have serious financial difficulties that they might ordinarily be able to manage without it becoming a disabling depression. So there are so many things that impinge on our mood, that push on our mood. And one reason that so many people are getting depressed now is that so many things at once are pulling mood down, and only some of them are things that we were aware of.
And now a big problem, and it was a problem for me, that I wasn't quite sure of what was making me so depressed. You say that we feel compelled to tell ourselves stories about our moods, and we feel bad when we have no story.
That's right. And I think it's very important to try to ask the question, what is this mood telling me? But very often people need help with this, especially if they're in a serious depression. And I would hope that my book would help people realize that it's okay. It's okay to see a counselor. It's okay to talk to your friend about your depression and to try to get their help and their insight. Often it takes some time to figure out what are the things what are the reasons, what are the factors, but that we need to be open to this. We're often very, in the U.S. Particularly, we want a quick fix, and I understand that. Depression is painful. Why should I have to suffer even one more hour with this? And so I think people might find my book, on the one hand, very refreshing in a new approach, but very frustrating in that I'm not saying, here are the three things to do to get relief from your depression in a week or in 2 weeks. The book is about starting a wider conversation about the sources of mood, and some of them actually point to things that we already know help. So we know, for example, that treatment, whether it's medication or cognitive behavioral therapy for depression, does bring many people relief, but many people don't actually seek help, or they don't recognize that they have this problem in themselves for many of the reasons we've already talked about.
Now, I want to come back and talk a little bit about loss. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with Dr. Jonathan Rottenberg. His book is The Depth, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. Now, I actually find you're selling yourself a little short on this, because I see throughout your book that there are these insights that can help people, and this is a major one. You say that the theme that most consistently predicts depression is loss, this idea of a loss event, and you write that clinicians working with patients, these are psychiatrists, psychologists, see the importance of uncovering a loss event. You write about this woman who moved to Florida. She was missing her old job and feeling a loss of esteem. She didn't have the people, thinking she was great that she used to at her job, maybe. And the therapist said that the patient might gloss over this loss and cite problems with her marriage or energy. But until this is addressed, she'll stagnate. So it's very important to see, have you lost something?
Yes. Grief and bereavement is the prototypical situation throughout our evolution and evolution of our mammalian friends. When we're a very social species, and when we lose someone who's important that we're attached to, we are wired to experience this pullback in behavior, to experience this low mood, to analyze, where am I now? Where am I going to get the help that I need to survive and reproduce? This may not be something that happens with language. It's something that happens automatically. So a gorilla will do it when the gorilla loses its baby, and certainly humans do it. And we have all kinds of rituals to help people grieve the loss. So people get social support. They get people telling them stories to try to integrate, understand what happened. The problem is with other sorts of losses that aren't a death, so you lose your fortune, you lose your wife, I'm sorry, you lose your marriage, or you lose your job, we don't have these rituals. And people often don't make a connection between these kinds of losses and their mood. And sometimes these things take a while. There can be a distance between when the loss happens and when the mood starts. So, for example, I have a person that I write about in the book who's a college freshman, and his parents broke up the summer before his freshman year. And initially, he was just in shock, and the circumstances of the breakup were very confusing. He didn't really process it until he went to college, and he started having all this anxiety, and he started to feel really depressed. He had no experience with depression before. He had no idea that it was really stemming from this confusion about, I just basically lost my family. The sudden breakup of the parents, both of whom you were close to, they no longer living in the same house, no longer had the same relationship with either one. And this was an event that needed to be processed and was related to his mood. So I think that's very common, that people experience some kind of loss and there isn't the help, there isn't the recognition that this needs to be kind of integrated and discussed and recognized.
Yeah, and this is why I think it's so important that you bring out this evolutionary understanding of depression and mood, because you say that the mood system monitors key relationships. We're a social species. And, for example, I had bereavement researcher George Bonanno on my show, and he talks about how his thinking is that visibly grieving sends a message to others that we're a caring partner and a good bet for the future. That sounds a little horrible in a certain way. You know, you're already advertising, but you don't know you're doing that. And you pointed out the death of a child is something people grieve deeply over. He said it's the most severe grief. And this fits also with our evolutionary imperative that we're our moods are directing our reproduction and survival. And so it would seem completely sensible that the most grievous grief is having your child die.
That's right. And when the child, you know, this is a horrible thing to even mention, but, you know, when the child is an older child nearing reproductive age, it's actually the biggest blow of all. The grief is the most severe than if it were, for example, an infant. And this does happen beneath the surface. We don't consciously think this, but we are configured, we are wired to behave in this way and to think this way, and it is organized by the mood system saying in effect to us, your reproductive chances just went down a lot, and you need to rethink what is your strategy. And you need to change. But in the meantime, you need to stop. You need to stop. And it is this, as George Bonanno said, a very social process of figuring out how can I rebuild these resources? What can I do? And it's signaling to others that I need help to do this.
And now I wanted to ask you also, this is a big question for a lot of people, how successful or unsuccessful are antidepressants in combating depression?
I think that people need to be very active, advocates on their own behalf, kind of champions of their own mood. And that means that people need to use all the tools at their disposal, but they need to recognize that antidepressants are just a tool. They're not a cure. Antidepressants leave about two-thirds of people who take them with some degree of symptoms. So you shouldn't go into taking antidepressants with the expectation that my depression is going to be cured, I'll have no symptoms, I'm going to be happy forever. That's not a great idea we talked about already. But with antidepressants, to manage your expectations for them and also to think that I might want to also change other things about my life. So I'm very comfortable with people taking that antidepressants, but I'm very nervous that in many cases people have been overpromised. It's out there in the culture that this is kind of the go-to. You take a pill, you don't need to talk about it, you should expect, you know, really rapid results. And the data really don't support that at all.
Yeah, and now maybe this was a placebo effect, but when I was depressed, I went to a psychiatrist and he gave me Zoloft, and I personally right away felt that it shaved the sharp edge off. And it basically, for me, it worked like training wheels for how to start feeling like myself again instead of having this weight on me. But I know it doesn't work for everyone, and I really love that you brought that up, because I think people feel that there's something terribly wrong with them if this thing that sounds like everyone makes fun of it is, oh, take a pill and you'll be better, if they take a pill and nothing happens.
Right. You know, this book is not anti-psychiatry. It's critical of psychiatry. But psychiatrists have an important role to play in prescribing medications. And for severe depression, it's very difficult for someone who's totally immobilized to engage in the kind of thinking that we've talked about in the rethinking. So I do think the training wheels model makes a certain amount of sense, and that it might allow you, put you in a position to make other changes. But the problem is, many people start on medications with the hope that this is going to be their salvation. And it is very much a trial and error process, and it can take a very long time. People become very frustrated. They think when the first antidepressant works, oh, I must be really broken. I must have the worst depression. Antidepressants can't make me better. Nothing can make me better. And they end up feeling very despondent. They lose hope because they don't have a sense for the large number of things that you can do to improve your mood. And so I'm very I'm worried that people over-rely on medications, but I think that they are our friend, and that people just need to become more critical. And consumers of medications, just like they become more critical consumers, say, of self-help books. I'm not saying don't read books that promise, but just realize that that you may need to do more than read a book.
Now, one thing that I found very hopeful and actually true, and I've read about this in George Bonanno's book also, you talk about how the mood system typically has natural resilience. We evolved to be resilient, to get up from our failures, to not persist in stupid things where we're just going to keep failing. And you talk about activities that people engage in to resolve grief. So they're bereaved, they've lost somebody, or their marriage has fallen apart. And you say these offer clues to stop low mood from escalating. And one of these involves, as you say, changes in cognition. So you change your thinking. You rework what the meaning is of events. And I think that's a big deal. I had Oprah Zura on my show talking about PTSD, and that's the way he tries to help people through that, to look at a situation and talk about what the meaning is. What does this mean positively? What have you learned? How can you go forward and take something better out of it? And I think you have a similar view.
Yes, we're incredibly resilient, incredibly resilient. And I know the book is hard in that it's talking about these many things that are making depression worse, and recognizing that we're in a bad situation societally with depression. But depressions end. Many depressions never start because of our impressive abilities to cope. And in fact, we're hit with all kinds of really horrible things from the beginning, when the child learns that that we're all going to die, to watching the news, and the news tends to focus on things that are very upsetting and violence and man's inhumanity to man. And most of the time, amazingly, you can engage with this material, turn off the TV, and 30 seconds later, you're back exactly where you were before. So we're incredibly resilient. And so part of my perspective would be to try to understand how it is that the mood system ordinarily is able to right itself
and
try to draw on those things.
I want to get to that, but I wanted to bring up another thing that you said that's very important. And see, this thing of where you talk about, look for the loss event. You say that resolving grief often involves filling in behavioral gaps. So if you see a person's departed, routines are disrupted, the bed is empty, that maybe the key to resolving the loneliness and longing of your grief is venturing forth, seeking out new people, renewing old relationships. I mean, you don't always want to do this. I sometimes find myself, I make myself leave the house and go out for drinks with somebody because I'm a social person. And I know that even though I think, like, oh, I have to get dressed, I have to put on mascara, what a drag, that it will make me very happy once I do it.
Yes. It's actually amazing. So there's this treatment for depression called cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's called cognitive behavioral therapy because it involves both changing your cognitions and changing your behavior. And one of the interesting things, and it's a relatively effective treatment for depression, but one of the amazing things is that some researchers wondering what it was about cognitive behavioral therapy that was so useful and powerful, they actually stripped it down and removed the cognitive part. And they did a strictly a behavioral therapy, which is very much what you're talking about, which is identifying, you know, you're depressed, but identifying things that you can do, things that you can do that are short-term, immediate ways to venture forth and to receive some reinforcement, some reward, and helping the person enumerate the kinds of activities that might be helpful to them. And research has found to a remarkable degree that in this complicated therapy, the small part of it, the behavioral part of it alone, works for depression about as well as the whole therapy. So it very much validates what you're saying about the role of behavior and the things that people can do to receive reinforcement. So finding out, you may be depressed, but what are the few things that you can do? You might think they're a challenge, you know, to put on makeup, to get dressed, to venture forth in the house, to meet a friend for coffee, but 90% of the time, the person is glad for having done that, and you can build on that.
Yeah, I'm glad you say that. You know, and I want to ask you about some smaller things you can do because maybe they seem silly. You know, if you're putting on makeup and going out for coffee, you're behaving as if you are a well person, and I'm not depressed now. I just do that. I'm busy. But
right.
I had Richard Wiseman on the show, and he writes about expanding on Henry James's work. Henry James is a novelist. He talks about being, doing things as being better than thinking for change. And so, and he even talks about smiling and laughing, you know, that those help you feel better. And so do you feel that silly and insane that you just force yourself to smile and laugh and it can help you? I mean, not out of a major depression perhaps, but maybe if you're in a, having a more minor depression, that you can use that to lift yourself.
I think that it could help in any form of depression. And one thing that I think is super important is for people to take depression seriously and to realize that for someone who is experiencing a serious depression, the smallest things represent things that the person should feel proud about. So it's hard to go to a, when you're feeling depressed, the last thing you want to do 90% of the time is to go to a party. You don't want to see anyone. You don't want to talk to anyone. You feel horrible about yourself. I have nothing to say. Right? And it is a tremendous effort, tremendous effort. And you might not actually have fun at the party. You might have fun. You might not have fun. But as you say, it's acting like you're not allowing the depression to get all of you. And you're showing that you can marshal normal behavior. And so the person, I think an important thing is recognizing that they're doing the right thing and that they should take some pride. There are a lot of people walking around with 1,000 pounds on their shoulder. And giving the person praise, giving the person kind words for acting, you know, bearing that weight and doing the little things, I think is an important step for many people, restoring a sense of normalcy. Because it could take a long time for a depression to lift. So you have to, you know, the expression, fake it until you make it, I think there really is a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, that's what Wiseman says. And I love this word you used, heroic, because it really is, and that counters this idea of, hey, you live in the most prosperous nation on earth. You're not in India. You have a refrigerator. You know, that we feel like babies, that we are depressed, but it really is a huge weight. And I think that people who can understand that, yes, it is heroic just to go to a party when you feel this way, and that being and doing can really help change your feelings. This is really positive, as opposed to this sort of, you jerk, you aren't grateful for what you have thinking.
Absolutely. And that feeling of heroism should really stay with the person after they've finished with their depression. Overcoming a serious depression is one of the most difficult things that a human being can do. I mean, I after my depression, I've done a lot of things that I'm proud of. I've run 3 marathons. I'm really proud of that. But getting out of serious depression is a lot harder than training for and running 26.2 miles. And people who've overcome depression have all sorts of resources. In some sense, I think that one of the problems in not talking about depression is that all these people who have overcome it aren't able to recognize that they've done something and that they can help other people who still may be struggling with depression. So I really think this is important to recognize the heroism of everyday life for people who are struggling, but also afterwards and making sense for what happened, because it can be an incredible trial for a human being to endure, but people do, sometimes more than once.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, how depression changes your thinking in positive ways. This is Amy Elkhorn's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Jonathan Rottenberg. He's a psychologist and director of the Mood and Emotion Laboratory at the University of South Florida, and his very insightful book we've been discussing is The Depth, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. So talk about that, how when somebody's been depressed, they can come out and have their thinking can change in positive ways. Their approach to life can change in positive ways.
Sure, and I think I have to be personal here because this happened to me. So I had a spouse who saw me through this depression. And in retrospect, I'm astonished that she stuck it out with me. I was awful. I was self-absorbed like most depressed people are. I was in pain. I was not functional. Once I got through the depression, I recognized what a gift that Laura had given me. I mean, she was part of what enabled me to survive. And I never saw my marriage in the same way again. I had a child in the middle of my depression. One of the craziest things that we decided to do was to continue this pregnancy with me in this terribly compromised state. I don't think that had I not been depressed that I would be so grateful for having a family and looking at my daughter and realizing that I have this precious thing, that depression didn't take everything. And you can get in a – sometimes, I wish I could do this more often, the experience of being punished and having a horrible mood for weeks and months and, in my case, years on end. The absence of that and the ability to do the simple things and more complicated things like writing a book, I have a new appreciation. And, I think a lot of other people who have depression have that as well, but it's not something that's talked about. And I think it should be.
Yeah, and this is why I find your book so valuable. You talk about how this has to become a conversation and these things that you got out of it, because you don't you do not minimize your depression. There's this sentence, I don't usually cry when I'm reading a science book, but I did. I teared up. You said this thing. Let me see if I can find this. I feared my girl, this dear little girl, would soon figure out the truth that she had a broken dad. That is just so heartbreaking. But then you wrote about how finding purpose in your life, that you want to convey what you found out about depression to people and these ideas. And there really are, you keep minimizing it, but in your book, The Depth, there are these ideas throughout. You do say, here's some advice too a few times on how to look at this, how to maybe come out of it. One of them is gratitude, you know, that you look at your life and you appreciate things. And that sounds sort of minimal, but that actually is. You looked at what you had, you know, in your life, your daughter, your career, the possibilities, and that seemed to really help you.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea that you have a kind of wisdom, a kind of perspective on the world that you didn't have before, and I feel a tremendous sense of obligation to try to help people, and maybe a sense of altruism that I didn't have. I mean, it deepened me, I think, as a person, to be perfectly honest. Not that I was a shallow, selfish, you know, jerk, but I'm just much more sympathetic to people who struggle, and I believe that I can be a resource, and that other people who have gone through these kinds of experience also have these gifts that they can give to others. And it's really a very different perspective on depression and its aftermath than we typically hear.
I mean to cut you off a little bit. I really think it's important, and that we take this out of the closet. And I've come out in my column. I said, look, I have ADD. I take Adderall. It changed my life. It used to be, thinking used to be, you know, like being, you know, attacked by 16 crows while you're trying to get out of thought. And, you know, these things, it just shows, look, I'm not embarrassed about this. And you talk about having people wear bracelets that indicate them as people who are dealing with depression. So it's not this sort of horrible closet thing, this thing, well, we live in the most prosperous nation on earth, and you can't even find, you know, some gratitude for that. So we're not thinking that way and blaming people for suffering.
That's right. In addition to the book, I've started a campaign called Come Out of the Dark. And the Come Out of the Dark campaign is very much aimed at people who have experienced depression, people who've cared for people who experienced depression. We all know someone who's struggled. And so you can wear a wristband that says Come Out of the Dark for yourself. You can wear it for someone that you love. You can wear it in memory of someone who struggled with depression. And it's really designed, again, to open up our national conversation, help confront this terrible stigma and shame that regrettably still seem to surround this condition, try as we might to change that.
Thank you. This has been such an illuminating show. I've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Rottenberg. His book is The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. Jonathan, thank you so much for a truly wonderful show and a wonderful book.
Thank you. It was really a privilege to speak with you.